Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, let's get this road show back on the road. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is our last hour. If you'd like to be on the program, call this number, please, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Let's start off in Bernalillo, New Mexico. Talk to Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is on the humanity and divinity of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Was this something that, did he ever have to like consciously separate at certain times, or you know what I mean? Like did he say, mm-hmm. well, this moment is going to be human or this is going to be divine? Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. So we're dealing here with the incarnation as such, and it's very difficult for us to try to imagine what it is. I mean, how is it that you can be God and man simultaneously with the things that are proper to both natures? In your divine nature, you know everything that can be known. You're all-powerful, all of the things that are proper to God. As God, Jesus had those things in his divinity. And keep in mind that he was a divine person. Now, in his humanity, he experienced all those things proper to humanity, but at a much higher level than you and I ever have. So he did have limitations, that's for sure, and he had to learn in his human intellect. He had to learn how to walk and talk and, you know, brush his teeth and all the things that children have to do when they grow up, and then, of course, learning more and more. But one of the things that we know about Jesus is that he always had the beatific vision. And he had infused knowledge. You and I don't have infused knowledge. Typically, most people do not have infused knowledge, although God can give that to some people. That's where you have knowledge of things that are revealed to you directly, and you know this in your mind. Jesus had that too. So did he switch back and forth? I don't think so. I don't think we could use that terminology. I don't think it would be accurate. It'd be in a way like if you had a socket wrench and you're switching between metric and standard, you know. No, I don't think it was like that at all. I think that in a seamless way, the human nature of Jesus being drawn to himself as an instrument was used deftly and perfectly and effortlessly by himself as God as an instrument. So he wasn't switching back and forth. It wasn't like he, okay, well, for the next 10 minutes, I'm just going to be human, and then I'll go back to being God again. It was always God and man simultaneously from the moment of the beginning of the incarnation. I think that's the best way I can describe it, that it was not one or the other, but always both.
Okay, yeah, it makes, I guess, enough sense. Like you say, we can never, I guess, fully understand it, but that mm-hmm. does make sense to me now. Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah, we do the best we can, and it's right, admittedly right. Not easy. Hey, have you ever had a chance to read that book I recommend all the time called Theology and Sanity by Frank Sheed?
Yeah, you know, and I was just thinking about that a few minutes ago, and I said, I need to get that book.
It's really good. Book. Yeah, you know what would happen, Paul? I could tell you what would happen if all 5 million people who listen to the Patrick Madrid Show every morning, if every one of you read this book, I would never have any phone calls because you would all know so much oh, cool. more about these issues. My phone calls would dry up. I'd have to find something to talk about.
Right. That was going to be my next question. Like if would it be possible for your 3-hour show to just be my questions one day?
Well, I think there might be some programming difficulties with that, but I'm always here to take your questions, Paul. I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go now to David in Miami. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi there.
Hello?
Yes. How can I be of service?
Yeah. I just been to your show. I respect your knowledge and everything. I just had a clarification because I'm trying to study the Bible, and I asked someone that was of the Hebrew Israelite tradition, and they told me that the Mark, I think it's Mark chapter 18, verse 19, and I think 18 and 19. No, but Mark chapter 7, verse 18 and 19, and the book talk about making all things clean. And the person was saying that, well, it wasn't really making all things clean. It was just the hand washing and the traditions of the Pharisees, not really.
Could you give me the verse again, David? I just want to look it up to make sure I understand that I'm following what you're saying. What was that verse again?
Okay, I'm not 100% sure. I think it's Mark chapter 7, verse 18 and 19. I believe that.
Okay, let me take a look here. So, and he said to them, Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach, and so passes on? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's yes.
Okay, got it. So I've got that in front of me now.
Yeah, upon reading it, to me it seems like, he's saying that whatever goes into your mouth, that would include food or, you know, would not make you unclean or defile you, right? And so, and the person was saying, well, yeah, but he was talking about the traditions. And then I was doing some research on that last part, first declaring all foods unclean. There seems to be some type of controversy or that was added later. And then said, well, it was originally there. And so I just wanted your understanding of that. Did he, you know, how does the Catholic Church understand it?
Okay. Well, my understanding, David, of this passage is that Jesus was drawing a line here that whereas before in the Mosaic Covenant, certain foods were deemed to be unclean. So pork, for example, and shellfish as another example. So in the mitzvot, the 613 different ceremonial laws of the Mosaic Law, certain animals were declared unclean and thus forbidden to the Israelites. They were not permitted to consume them. And so here, when we read this passage, we see that St. Mark is saying, as Jesus says, do you not see that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and so passes on? Thus he declared all foods clean. So Mark is giving this parenthetical comment. Thus, by saying this, Jesus was declaring all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a man is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a man. So you ask, you know, what is the Catholic Church's understanding of this? There really isn't a Catholic Church teaching, here's what this verse means. But I think the preponderance of what the Church Fathers and the doctors of the Church say, and this is what I'm trying to channel here, is that Jesus is drawing a distinction between physical things like food that in themselves, they don't defile you because they don't, you know, if you eat a piece of pork, it doesn't defile you in the way that licentiousness or deceit or all the other things that he talks about that come out of you do defile you. So it seems to me that he's setting the stage here now for the eventual abrogation, the eventual fulfillment of the Mosaic Law with all of those requirements, showing that there's something higher and better and perfect and complete in God's plan that transcends foods that are considered ritually unclean. I think that's the essence of that passage. Now, I hope I'm not missing your point, and if I did, please tell me what it is. But does that answer your question? Does that get to the heart of what you're wondering about?
I mean, I think so. I like the way that you framed it and you sort of approached it, because you're drawing the distinction between spirit and physicality. I like that. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
I had one more. Is that okay?
Sure. No? Go ahead.
I heard on the radio. I keep hearing people saying that Sunday is a Sabbath, and my understanding is that Sunday is the Lord's day. The Sabbath has always remained a Sabbath. Is that Is that correct? Sabbath maybe.
Yeah,
seven,
you're correct. Yeah, so the Sabbath, you're right. The Sabbath is the seventh day, and that's Saturday. And Sunday is the first day of the week, and that's the Lord's Day. And so I think it's more probably just sort of Christian shorthand, you know, keep holy the Sabbath day, because that's what it says in Exodus chapter 20. It refers to the Sabbath or the seventh day, the day on which God rested. But the church had the authority from Jesus to transfer the observance of that commandment from the seventh day of the week to the first day of the week, Sunday, the Lord's Day. So we kind of use the word Sabbath as a synonym for the Lord's Day and vice versa. I think that's what you're hearing.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You got it, David. Right. Thank you for calling and thank you for listening. Let's go now to Jack in, of all places, Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning to you, Patrick. Say you've recommended some excellent books in the past, and I'm hoping maybe you can recommend one for me.
Okay, happy situation.
To. Okay. Yes, sir. Here's my situation. I have a casual friend, but he happens to be a Wiccan. Okay. And his birthday is coming up pretty soon, and I'd like to get him a book that would hopefully lead him away from Wiccanism and toward Catholicism.
Okay. That's a worthy project.
And so I was thinking of first of that gentleman, it's on the tip of my tongue now, Zachary King. And I checked his website, but I don't think he's written any books along those lines. But then I thought of calling you.
Okay. And I don't know who that is, so I can't really comment without knowing that person.
Okay.
But I do know this. So in the Surprised by Truth book series, there are four in the series. So the first one that came out in 1994, the second one came out, I don't know, 2000 maybe, something like that. And then there were two others that came out up to the last one, which is called Surprised by Life. Now, in the second Surprised by Truth, or Surprised by Truth number two, there is a chapter by a former Wiccan. And when I edited the book, I was in charge of choosing, I was choosing titles for chapters. And the title that I gave to that one is Wiccan Work It Out, because I'm a Beatles fan. What can I say? So that particular book would be one that I know has something that directly speaks to the issue of Wicca. And this, let me get the name of the guy who wrote it. So it was written by, where is he? John Gibson. And this is in volume two, so Surprised by Truth 2. John Gibson's chapter is about how, as a Wiccan, he found the Catholic faith. He found Jesus, and he found the Catholic faith, and he tells his story. So that's about, I don't know, probably about 12, 15 pages long. Now, there are other stories in this book from other people of different backgrounds, which might be interesting for your friend, but one that comes directly from Wicca and who talks about what he believed as a Wiccan, and he was involved in the early days of AOL in the 90s. He ran the Wiccan Forum for AOL, which is an international, at that time anyway, it was an international forum, and he ran that and associated forums as well. So he was deeply immersed in it. And what's interesting about this story is he talks about how in the middle of all that and being out there promoting Wicca, he actually encountered Jesus and became a Catholic. So of all the things that may be out there that I'm unaware of, I do know about this. And I think that story could be very beneficial for your friend to listen to, so, or to read rather. So that much I can recommend.
Okay, great. I'll check that out. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jack. And a little bit of Googling might turn up some other things. I'll keep my eye out. And if I do run across something else that would be helpful, I think that would be good. One other book that comes to mind now that I think about it is Peter Crave's book called Fundamentals of the Faith. And not that this deals with Wicca, because it doesn't, but it does deal with world religions as such. So Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, and all of these world religions he looks at through the lens, you might say, of Jesus Christ, and he compares and contrasts with them. So it's a very ironic book. It's not polemical. It's not pushy. It's very insightful. And I wouldn't be surprised if your Wiccan friend might see some things in that book that could help him and draw him closer to Jesus. So that book is called Fundamentals of the Faith by Peter Kraft. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate it. Let's go to Marie now in Illinois. Hi, Marie.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had just a really quick question about what anything that you knew about the American Catholic Church. My husband and I were recently on vacation, and we always just go online to see what parish and mass times are convenient close to where we're staying. And we found one. The name of it was Holy Family Catholic Church. But when we got there, it was just a really tiny 100-year-old building that they actually share with the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Church owns it, but the Catholic Church, once we got in there and went through the Mass and looked at their bulletin and so forth, we realized we were not in a Roman Catholic church.
You were not.
So, no. And so, I mean, lots of things were similar. There was no tabernacle. There was just a statue of the Holy Family. They did have a beautiful picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So there were just things about it that were similar, but then no penitential rite. They had a screen up on the wall where they had the Gospels and so forth. He wore vestments. I mean,
I can explain.
I can explain.
Yeah. And by the way, was this for Sunday Mass?
Yes, it was a Sunday Mass. And it was noted in their bulletin after I was reading through it that it was National Inclusive Catholicism Sunday. I'd never heard of that.
Okay. So the reason I asked you that question is, did you by chance go to Mass at a Catholic church after that? Because it didn't fulfill your Sunday obligation to go there. But, I mean, you weren't culpable if you didn't know, if you were under the misimpression that it was somehow related to the Catholic Church, which it's not. But just FYI, if you should ever find yourself in that situation, going to one of those places doesn't fulfill the Sunday obligation. So just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, this is an organization that is like many others. They're a dime a dozen. And you have, depending upon which group you're looking at, you've got typically a renegade priest who might have been dismissed from the priesthood for serious sins, or he broke away because he wanted to get married, or he got himself into some other trouble. Usually these kinds of groups start this way. And they hive off and they'll try to get ordained a bishop in some cases by a renegade bishop who had similar problems. And there are many of them out there who have valid holy orders, but they're illicitly celebrating Mass and they're illicitly consecrating other bishops and they're illicitly ordaining priests, etc. So these are like dandelions. They pop up, they come out of nowhere. You know, you come out the next morning and, hey, where did this come from? It wasn't there yesterday. And it probably won't be there in another 5, 10, 15 years. These things tend to fall apart or they merge with other groups or their leadership comes and goes. And so they're like dandelions. They're like weeds, basically. They pop up and then they eventually disappear. Or they pop up and they just keep mutating into one thing after another over time. That's what you saw. You saw a church that claims to be Catholic. It claims to be associated with the Catholic Church, but it's not. And even though some of the sacraments, such as baptism, for example, or the Holy Eucharist, in the case of a priest who has been validly ordained, if he went rogue and he's doing this now contrary to the will of Christ and the will of the Church, that's a serious sin for him. But it could still be a valid Mass. It could still be a valid Holy Eucharist. But you should have nothing to do with it whatsoever because it is completely dissociated from the Church. And what they're doing is seriously sinful. Often, and I've had some experience with groups like this, like the Old Catholics in Southern California, I got to know one of their clergymen in the early 1980s, really nice guy. He and I were working in the same area together, and he and I hit it off. And when he found out I was Catholic, and he told me that he had been raised Catholic, we started having lunch together periodically. And long story short, he had been ordained as a Catholic priest in that offshoot group. And eventually he became a bishop. And I don't know if he's still alive anymore. He may have died. but it just becomes progressively more extreme, ordaining women, promoting homosexuality, promoting all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the gospel. And one of the things that these different groups seem to have in common is they seem to all more or less generally agree that these moral issues that the Catholic Church teaches on things like human sexuality or marriage and divorce or abortion, contraception, things like that, one of their calling cards tends to be, across these various groups, we are the inclusive Catholic Church. You can come here and get the smells and bells, and you can see statues of Mary, and we'll wear vestments, and we'll do all the pantomiming of Catholic things. But contraception, no problem. Abortion, no problem. Gay marriage, no problem. You know, we're inclusive, and this is how we are, and everybody's welcome, and all that claptrap. That's what's going on in those kinds of churches. So stay far away from them. They are not doing anything that is, in my view at least, they're not doing anything pleasing in God's eyes. They're just creating more confusion and more problems for people who are being led away from the truth. I guess I'll have to leave it at that. I do have to take a break. And sorry to break the bad news, Marie, but I wouldn't go there anymore. I have a feeling you probably already reached that conclusion, though. I'll be right back with more right after this.
Follow Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Madrid.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutaback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's get back to it. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Andrew in St. Charles, Illinois. Hello, Andrew. Welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So I have a couple questions. Hope you don't mind. First
go
one
for
is,
it.
Can spiritual demons take physical form?
Yes, they can.
Interesting. Hope you don't mind, but could you like maybe go just a little bit more on that? Or
sure. So let's go. Yeah, let's take what we see in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3. We know that the evil one, Lucifer, the devil, he took the form of a serpent. We don't know exactly. Was it a dragon serpent? Was it a snake serpent? We can imagine what it might have been, but he took a physical form. So he is an angel and a pure spirit, therefore. But he took a form, in this case, of a serpent or a dragon. There's one example. Or in the story of Tobit, where he wrestles with an angel, he took the form of a man and appeared in that way. Or in Genesis, where Abraham and Sarah are lodging by the terebinths of Mamre, and three angels appear to them in the form of three men. Or also in Genesis, where in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, two men who were actually angels, they appeared in the form of men. So much so that the Sodomitic inhabitants of those cities wanted to have carnal knowledge of them because they thought that they were actually men. So we could multiply examples, but there you see several in which good angels, in this case, and not to mention a bad angel in the case of the Garden of Eden, are taking a physical form.
Wow, that's interesting. Thanks for that.
Yeah, sure. No problem. And did you have a second question, Andrew?
Yeah, just one more. Mm-hmm. So, what is, like, sort of, it's not exactly power, but I've noticed that, like, in a lot of stories, holy objects like miraculous medals and scapulars and crucifixes or things like that, they kind of, like, they have a sort of, like, connection with God or something like that, and they kind of, like, help out in certain works. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's kind of like they have a mystical power, and I know that's not really the truth, but I kind of wanted to know a bit more on that. Like, yeah, if the Bible says anything on that or something.
Yes, I think it does. I think we should remember that they do have a kind of power, but not the power that some people might imagine. Like, let me put it this way. They're not magical in themselves. They don't have talismanic powers. They can't do anything for you as an object, but what they represent is powerful. So a crucifix represents the power of Christ's victorious death on the cross and his victory over Satan and evil. So the piece of wood or metal or whatever the cross might be made out of, it, in itself, it doesn't have any power of its own. But what it symbolizes is powerful. And when God makes use of a sacramental, like a cross, for example, or a Bible, for example, as another sacramental, holy water, rosary beads, candles, blessed candles, the blessing of a priest, genuflecting, making the sign of the cross, these are all sacramentals. And the power that they have, if you want to think of it in those terms, is by what they represent. And therefore, these representations of God's power are projected into your life. And this is where we have to be careful that we don't erroneously invest in these objects some imaginary mystical power that they themselves have, but it's rather what they represent. I don't want to repeat myself here. But there is power, but it's not power from the thing itself. It's power from what it represents and how God can make use of these symbols to demonstrate his truth, his goodness, his beauty, etc. Now, right. I'll juxtapose that with the sacraments. So the sacraments, so let's take the Holy Eucharist par excellence, that does have power in it. It's the power of God's grace, so sanctifying grace is truly conveyed to you through receiving the Holy Eucharist. The regeneration, the bath of rebirth, as the Bible calls it, the receiving of the Holy Spirit, the eradication of sin, really does happen to you as a result of being baptized with water, to use another example. So unlike the sacramentals, which are merely symbols, the sacraments are symbols, but they actually do what they symbolize. So there's a distinction between those two. I thought that was important to mention that part as well, because we don't look at the sacraments in the same way as we look at sacramentals. Sacramentals are mere symbols. Sacraments are symbols that actually do what they symbolize.
Yeah,
helpful?
Yeah. If I could just, like, could I also say, like, for the sacramentals, does it help if they're blessed?
Yeah, it does, because the blessing is something that further sets them apart for godly purposes. So a blessed candle, you know, some of the ones that I just mentioned, these are all, you might say, the power of their symbolism is heightened when they're blessed, because it's further setting them apart. Holy water, let's use holy water as an example. Holy water is water that has been blessed in a particular way by a priest. He can make regular water into holy water. And that's not something that I can do or that you can do. So I could take tap water and fling it around and say prayers of deliverance, but that's not holy water. So it becomes consecrated in a particular way when it has the blessing of a priest. Doesn't mean that it can't still function as a sacramental, because sacramentals don't require the blessing of a priest in order to function, but they become more powerful, you might say, when they have the blessing of a priest.
All right, thank you. That's very helpful.
I'm glad, Andrew. Thank you. These are great questions you're asking, so kudos to you. Let's go to Alex now in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hello, this is Alex.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, welcome.
All right. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Madrid.
You're welcome.
So I have been dealing with some cognitive dissonance, I'd say, for many years. Okay. And it has an effect on my faith. I'm Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I talked this issue over with my Catholic priest that plays the role of spiritual director, bring it up at least once a month in confession. My fiance and I actually decided that we're going to get married in the Episcopal Church this June instead. And I'm not saying I'm leaving the church. The issue is women in the priesthood. Because I have a hard time imagining, like, raising a daughter in a church that sends such a loud message refusing her leadership potential. And therefore, I can't honestly promise to raise my children in the Catholic Church right now. And that's a requirement if you want to get married in a Catholic church. Mm-hmm. So it's really messy in my head. I actually went to discernment retreat a few years ago because I was trying to decide if I was, well, this is many years ago, actually, but I was trying to decide if I was going to enter the priesthood. And we discussed this at length with the other priests there, and I learned a lot about it, but through all my studies and masses and prayers and sacraments and spiritual direction, I'm still pretty confused about why. So okay. I won't argue with your response. You know, this is your show and I listen to it most days and I love it. And I'd like to hear your point of view. But if you have any questions about kind of why I'm confused, just let me know. But I kind of want to give it to you and hear what you have
to say. That's a fair question. Fair question, and you're being open and honest about your struggle with this issue, so I can respect that. I think you're making the wrong decision by leaving the Catholic Church, at least to the extent that you're not getting married in the church, but that's a separate issue that I could, maybe we could talk about that at a future time. But for the moment, let me just say that I believe that you and I and everybody should come to Jesus on his terms and not dictate terms to him. And say that because I don't think it should be this way, therefore, Jesus, you're going to have to change the way you arrange things. That's the approach that I'm taking to this issue. And the Catholic Church points to Jesus and says, this is how he arranged it. Pope John Paul II, you may have read it, maybe you haven't, but it'd be worth reading. He wrote an apostolic letter called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, which is Latin for on priestly ordination. And in this rather brief document, he, number one, points to the fact that the church is obliged to follow Jesus in what he himself taught and did. And he points to the fact that Jesus did not choose women for the priesthood. And he does take into account some of the counter arguments like, well, that was just the result of a patriarchal society and Jesus couldn't, you know, break that rule or anything. And he explodes that myth because there were plenty of things that the mores and the social dictates of that culture required that Jesus completely ignored. So Jesus was not bound by the mores and the dictates of his culture. He was above all that, being God himself. And so arguments such as that well, Jesus only ordained men because that's what the culture required, those arguments don't really work. The main thing is, as John Paul II points out, this is what Jesus established, and this is what the apostles understood him to mean. And even Our Lady herself, who was the greatest human person ever to exist, even she was not chosen by the Lord for the priesthood. So if you haven't read that, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, I would encourage you to do so, because at the very least you're going to get a kind of a skeleton outline of the church, of the Pope John Paul II's thesis, which is that the church doesn't have the power to change this. The church can no more change this than the church could add another person to the Trinity and say that in the name of inclusion and diversity, we now believe that there are four persons in the Trinity, so a quadrinity. Why don't we add a woman, for example? The church has no power to do that because, number one, it's not revealed truth, and the church is the servant of revealed truth, not its master. So that's the operating principle that you'll find in what he has to say. If you wanted a longer and much more systematic dismantling of the feminist notion that women should have power, and that's a misunderstanding of the nature of the priesthood in any case, it's not about power. It's about service, but many people look at it through a different lens. But I would refer you to an article by Dr. Joyce Little, and it's called Women in Ordination. And it's a thoughtful, lengthy analysis of this of this issue, and it takes into account some of the people that you probably, maybe if you haven't read their works, at least you've been influenced by their thoughts. So Rosemary Radford Ruther, for example, or Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, for example, and others who have promoted a feminist critique of the Catholic Church's teaching on the ordination of women, or, you know, the lack of an ordination of women. And so what she does is she takes up their arguments, and one by one she goes through and offers a very, I believe, a very thoughtful, a very insightful, deeply biblical analysis of that, and shows, in essence, what Pope John Paul II said, and that is that the Church does not have the authority to do this. Which brings me back to my rhetorical question to you, and I have to take a break, so I'll leave it at that, but I'll also tell you where you can find this article. My proposal to you would be, in your prayers and your pondering of this issue, just ask yourself whether or not you are presuming to dictate the terms upon which you will be a Catholic. If, you know, if the Catholic Church doesn't agree with you, then the Church, then you're not going to be Catholic. I would propose that in your humility, you ponder whether or not you are willing to come to Jesus on his terms as he laid them out in his church that you're privileged to belong to. So I'll have to leave it at that, only because I'm overdue for a break, Alex, but do me this favor. I would encourage you to read this article by Dr. Joyce Little. It's called Women in Ordination, and we will have a link to this for you in just a matter of moments. You can find it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Look on the right side as you scroll down a little bit. You'll find a link to it. Give me 2 or 3 minutes to get it posted, and then it's there for you to take. There's also a PDF version of it, so if you wanted to print it out or what have you, share it with your fiancé, that would be helpful as well. And then call me back. Maybe after you've had a chance to digest that, we can discuss it a little bit further. And there are maybe a few other resources, but those two I think would be a good place to start. Thanks, Alex. I'll be right back with the last bit of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Follow Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Madrid.
Tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday,
coast to coast, on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day.
All right. Everyone loves this song. Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to Malgorzata, and I hope I'm saying your name correctly. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, and God bless you for all your work you're doing.
Thank you.
Bringing people close to God. Yeah, you're almost correct. Małgorzata is a Polish name.
Okay.
I have a question. I am grandma of two grandsons, Leo and Luca, 7 and 10 years old, and I am looking for a good book preparing them for good confession and Luca for First Communion. Because, you know, I'm speaking Polish, you know, I'm preparing in Polish, but they will better understand, you know, in English because they raised here, you know.
And how old did you say they are? They're like pre-first
Leo communion? Leo is 10 and 7. Luca will go next year, have first communion.
Okay. I am a really big fan of the St. Joseph edition of the Baltimore Catechism. And they have three books. These are illustrated, by the way. They have three books. The middle one is the one for preparation for First Communion. I believe it's the middle one. I think it's got a pink cover. So if you were to go to your local Catholic bookstore, do you have a Catholic bookstore in your area?
Yes.
Okay. So go in there and tell them you want the St. Joseph edition of the Baltimore Catechism. And they probably will have them on the shelf. And they're one that shows Jesus holding a host to give Holy Communion to a child. That's the one that's for that age group. But I would get all three of them. One is blue, one is pink, one is gray. The gray-covered one is for the older grades. I would get all three of them. And then start them off with the most basic one, and then let them read their way through the third and the highest one. It'll do them a lot of good and will really help them in preparation for the sacrament.
Okay. Could you please be so kind and tell me again, I have to ask for St. Joseph edition in blue, pink, and gray, and the author?
Yeah, so it's the St. Joseph edition of the Baltimore Catechism.
Oh, okay, of the Baltimore.
Right.
And
And those are three different volumes, and they're for the three age groups, youngest to oldest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there is one that's specifically for preparation for Holy Communion, and they're really good, really good.
Super. Thank you so much. God bless you, and I stay with prayer with you.
Thank you, Madre Grisanta. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go to Gabriella now in Houston, California. Gabriella, we haven't talked in a while. Welcome back.
Hi. How are you?
I am well, thank you. How old are you now? Last time we talked, I think you were 11.
Yeah, I'm 13 now.
Oh, so maybe you were 12 last time we talked. Okay. Yeah, I think the first time we talked, you might have been about 9 or thereabouts.
So, to get to my question, yesterday I was talking to my friend, and she said that what she was giving up for lunch, she's giving up sugar, and I'm giving up TV for, like, the sacrifice. She says that she's glad because that's hard for her, and she's glad because she can still do it on Sunday. But I was asking, is that mean Sunday? Does that mean that that's, like, not a sacrifice? Like, does that mean that we don't, like, sacrifice?
Like if you can relax what you're abstaining from during Lent on Sundays, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, the answer is you can if you want to. I mean, it's not like you're committing a sin or anything. The whole idea is to try to put up some sort of a struggle. And for some it's easier than others. And even for those who find maybe one Lent they're successful, in other Lents they may have more of a struggle. But the main thing is to abstain from something that you would otherwise like as a way to have some penance in your life. And there are two schools of thought. The traditional, more common way is to give up whatever it is you give up, to give it up for the entirety of Lent. So there are 40 weekdays during the 6 weeks of Lent, and there are 6 Sundays. So the traditional way is that you would give it up from Ash Wednesday until Good Friday. When that's over, Holy Thursday, you're out of Lent. And so more commonly, you would find people that would give up whatever they gave up, TV in this case, until you get to Holy Thursday. You know, and some people say until Easter, but once you're out of Lent, that's typically what would happen. Now, it is true that in earlier epochs in the church's history, and more so now, it seems, that there is a school of thought that says that you can take Sundays off. And I'll be honest with you, Gabrielle, that appeals to me quite a bit. Because if I gave up something for Lent, to have it on Sundays is a lot more, it's easier than to not have it at all for 40 days plus the 6 Sundays of Lent. So you have freedom to do either one, whichever one you prefer. It's not as though the church says you must do one or you must do the other. You can say the custom is what I'm going to follow, or the more common custom is what I'm going to follow. But if you relax it on Sunday, that's fine. Some would say it'd be better if you did it all the way through Lent, but you have that freedom. And there are two schools of thought. So there will be some people who will say, absolutely not. You shouldn't abstain or sacrifice on Sunday because Sunday is the Lord's Day and Sunday is not a penitential day. And I understand that. And that's true. But it doesn't mean that you can't fast on Sunday. It doesn't mean that you can't offer up some sort of penance or reparation on Sunday. But it is appealing to most people to say, sure, I'll take that day off. And anyway, you have that choice. You have that freedom to do it whichever way you wish.
Okay, thank you very much. I was just asking because in my head, the way I think logically, I think Jesus didn't give up on the Sabbath. That's what I think. He's still continued on. That's the way I think of it. And then also, Sunday is still Lent. Like, that's Lenten Sunday. So that's what I think of it, really.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I totally understand it. And what you're describing is the more traditional, more common view in the Latin Rite of the Church. In the Eastern churches, let's take them as an example, Gabriella, that's exactly how they do it. So they don't, not only do they observe Lent all the way through, including Sundays, in terms of their Lenten, whatever they're fasting from. But they don't just not eat meat on Ash Wednesday and the Fridays during Lent. They don't eat meat for the entirety of Lent. So nothing for those 40 days plus 6 Sundays. they don't have eggs, they don't have cheese, they don't have milk. In some of the more observant or the more rigorous Eastern churches, they don't have any of those things. So you're pretty much eating veggies all of Lent. That can get boring.
Yeah.
So in the Latin rite of the church, by comparison, we have it easier because what's required is so minimal compared to what some of the other Eastern churches anyway, what they do. So you are doing something that's more akin to the more traditional way of doing it.
Yeah, we do attend a Latin Mass on Sunday, so.
That's good. Happy to hear it.
But yeah, all right. Thank you very much, and God bless.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Nice chatting with you again. Maybe I'll talk to you next year when you're 14 years old. Let's see. Let's go to Joe now in Passaic, New Jersey. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
You're fine. What does it mean to desecrate a church?
Desecration of a church can be done in different ways, God forbid, but it would be, let's say somebody was murdered in a church. That would be a desecration of the church. Let's say that some... I won't be descriptive here, but let's say that some immoral action, some immoral sin were committed in a church, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be in the sanctuary, but let's say something like that happened. When something evil and sacrilegious at a level like that takes place in a church, that's a true desecration. And the church in her law actually has a provision for the reconsecration of a church that has been desecrated. So sometimes it gets so bad that the church needs to be reconsecrated.
Actually happens in deconsecration? If the Holy Spirit leaves the church? Or
Not so much that, because the Holy Eucharist, let's say, is still present in the tabernacle. But because of the terrible thing that was committed there, the bishop typically would be the one who would say, all right, until this church has been reconsecrated, it's no longer to be used for the celebration of the Mass. And then the bishop would set a date, and on this day we're going to reconsecrate the church, and it would be reconsecrated, re-blessed, and the... I was going to say the odometer would go back to zero, but it's not really like that per se. It's just that the church takes this so seriously that this is the house of God. This is where the Lord is truly present in the Blessed Sacrament. This is where the altar of sacrifice is, and the sacrifice of the Mass takes place. So if something diabolical and sacrilegious were to take place there, the church wants to make sure that this is reconsecrated to drive out any evil influences.
If it goes undetected, then what happens to
nothing.
All the things that happen from the time?
Nothing. There's nothing that happens to the church itself. I mean, there could be the influence of diabolical spirits. I mean, they are known to go in places where there are crucifixes and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's
so
for our benefit.
Baptisms would be legitimate, marriages and
everything
all that?
Would be legitimate. Everything. Every last thing would be legitimate.
Very good. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate your keep up the good work.
You got it, Joe. Thank you. Let's go to John now in California. We only have a minute or two, John, but what I have is yours.
Thank you. Good morning. So my pastor had asked me to become a deacon last year, Father Mason, right before he died. And I'm out in California, and I still have this vibe in me that, you know, between writing scripts and writing songs, that, as Eric Clapton might say, I can change the world. So I guess the question would be, when you know you could be of service through the diaconate program, and then you're taking a bit of a risk when you think that you can write songs and stories that have a pro-life, pro-Catholic, defend the church theme, that's the main question. The other one might be, would you have any suggestions how to pursue the latter? So,
a couple thoughts come to mind. Number one is that this is a vocation, so if you're called, then you should respond to the call, but you'd have to discern whether or not God is calling you. Obviously, the diaconate is not just another box of achievement to check off. You know, I got my PhD, check. I got ordained to the diaconate, check. It's not like that at all. It's only for you if you're called to it, and that's where discernment comes in. The other question that comes to my mind, John, is why couldn't you do both? I mean, if God indeed is calling you to the diaconate, I don't see why that would preclude you from writing songs and scripts and things like that. I mean, you could do both. So that's another possibility to consider as you discern. Well, I wish I had more time, John, but thanks for that. Appreciate that. I look forward to being back again with you all tomorrow, same Pat time, same Pat channel. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.